intersections that take place I hadn't anticipated, you know, I just accept that it is the Lord's will, do the best that we can. So at the outset today, I want to warn you, I'm about to present some material that is highly controversial. I didn't intend to do that while we were in the midst on Sunday mornings of highly controversial material. And so I can't tell you how nervous I've been for the last several months, maybe more so than I've ever been in all the years I've been preaching. But, you know, that's the nature of the game. It wasn't planned out that way, but that's how it fell out. And so this morning I had three different passages of Scripture that we were having read to us at the start. I'm going to refer to those very quickly here in just a moment. But as I mentioned leading into this sermon, in the midst of the morning's class, which made two controversial things in one class, and now the second one we'll be dealing with at more length, this 25th chapter of Matthew, I believe, is about exactly the same thing that Matthew 24 and 23 are about. I don't see any change in the material. I don't see Jesus suggesting that he changes the topic. So I believe that those three chapters are about the fall of Jerusalem. This artist's drawing, having been there myself, spent a lot of years studying the archaeological remains that we have, is by far, I think, the best representation of first century Temple Mount and the city itself at large that I've ever seen. And so I won't get into all the details here, but in the first century, the temple area looks something like this. I think it's 35 acres. The Mount of Olives is like that, and it's above, and you can look right down on it. And Jesus in Matthew chapter 23 had been in the area, be around on this side coming in from the east, but inside the temple courtyards itself, observed the woman, give her mite, and made a lesson out of that, and then said that this house was going to be left desolate. The house they were standing in, which is an astonishing idea to the disciples. And so they then leave, apparently through this, the eastern gate, went down in the Kidron Valley, or perhaps across the bridge, we're not sure about that part, ascended the Mount of Olives, and then up there on at the start of the 24th chapter, here looking down on the temple, Jesus has elaborated greatly upon the theme of the coming destruction of Jerusalem. We've studied chapter 23 and then chapter 24 last week, one chapter at a time. I'm going to labor to do that very same thing again here today. So in order to help us see the context, which is always preeminent in any Bible study, let us not lose our moorings in the context and then take our cultural upbringing and so many things that people commonly believe and start assigning those ideas to terms and expressions that have both biblical precedent to define them as well as timestamps that are placed on them so you know what we're talking about. Despite the fact that what I'm going to present this morning is not the most popular view, to say the least, it certainly is a becoming popular view. I don't know who believes what, but in the course of the 30 years I've been presenting this material, I've seen an awful lot of people recognize, you know, how those old ways are just not quite right. So let's start by looking at some of those expressions, the very ones that Jonathan read so capably a moment ago. In Matthew 10:23, Jesus said, "You, the disciples, the 12, will not finish the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes." He's sending them out on a preaching mission. He's using this term, Son of Man, or coming of the Son of Man, which is found repeatedly throughout Matthew and the other Gospels, and he's putting a time stamp on it. You men, in your lifetime, will not finish preaching all the cities in Israel before the Son of Man comes. Now, there'll be preaching done by others in all the nations, you know, that Rome had conquered. There'll be preaching by Paul among the Gentiles too. But those 12 would not even be able to finish preaching just the cities in Israel themselves before the Son of Man comes. Then in chapter 16, verses 27 and 28, the 28th verse says, "Some of those standing here will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom." Son of Man is coming. He is coming to establish a kingdom. That is the great hope of the Old Testament. They'd be a part of that kingdom. He's going to be coming here before you taste death. Then in Matthew 23, we saw 2 weeks ago, verses 35 and 36, upon you, speaking to the Pharisees, he castigated so many times, will you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, upon you will fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth. All these things will come upon this generation. By the way, you should take note, the word for earth here is not the whole world. It's the word that is used, land of Judah, land of Naphtali. It's talking about the land of Israel. Upon you, Pharisees, will fall all the guilt of the righteous blood. All these things will come upon this generation. Then, in Matthew 24, as we saw last week, however you understand the symbology of which there's an enormous amount, all of which you can find in the Old Testament, talking about the destruction of physical cities by invading armies, and attached to that is the idea that when that happens, because God sent the invading army, then God, as if he were a general directing his forces, rides on a cloud. That is very common in the Old Testament. Several nations where it's described as coming on the clouds in judgment when God sends one nation to destroy another. Here he says, when you see all these things, he's near, right at the door. This generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Now then, if you'll open up to Matthew 25. I'd like for us to go awfully rapidly, but you might want to get your pencil out. Just highlight a couple of things here. Immediately now, in Matthew chapter 24, in 24, after this statement, in this generation, all these things will happen, look what he does in 36. Of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. We talked about that last week. But there's only one coming in view. It's the coming in the age. It's the coming that they're asking about in the first three verses of Matthew 24. You're going to know the generation. It's this generation before you men can even finish all the cities of Israel, that all these things in this chapter will take place. But you won't know the day or the hour. You know the generation. You don't know the day or the hour. Skip down to verse 39. They did not understand, this is how it's like the days of Noah, until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. The only coming they asked about, the only coming Jesus has been talking about, the coming that's been time-stamped for this generation before you guys die, before you even finish the cities of Israel, the Son of Man is going to come. But most people won't understand it. They're not going to recognize it. They don't know the day or the hour. Now skip down to 42. Therefore, be on the alert. You do not know which day your Lord is coming. Skip down to verse 44. For this reason, you be ready too. For the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think. Look at the next to the last verse in the chapter. The master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect and at an hour which he does not know. And shall cut him in pieces, assign him a place where the hypocrites weeping will be there and the gnashing of teeth. Now, brethren, I just want us to observe, if we're going to study this chapter contextually, Jesus does not change horses in midstream. Jesus does not skip over two millenniums to go talk about the end of the world. He keeps telling them, in their generation, all these things will take place. But you won't know the day or the hour, he says now, five times immediately after that. So be alert, be ready, be ready, be ready, be ready. You'll see it. It's this generation's before you die, before you even finish the cities of Israel. Now, they're not going to know the day or the hour. These are the verses that we just talked about in Matthew 24. What happens next? Look again at 24. Verses 37 through 44 are a parable, or a reference maybe is a better term, a discussion about how people, though they had been warned, did not know that the flood was coming. So it's like Noah in that sense alone. Not a global judgment, but a surprising judgment. Then we have parable number two. You have a faithful slave in verses 45 through 51. Then we have, in chapter 25, another such illustration. 10 virgins, verses 1 through 13. Then, number 4, we have the parable of the talents. That's in chapter 25, verses 14 through 30. In other words, after he had just said, a matter of 2 or 3 verses later, but after he had just said, all these things will take place in this generation, he says, you're not going to know the day or the hour, so be faithful. You're not going to know the day or the hour, so be faithful. You're not going to know the day or the hour, so be faithful. You're not going to know the day or the hour. So be faithful. Then we have the judgment scene of verses 31 through 46, which is the now controversial part. All my life I was taught by all my forefathers that this is about the final judgment. Jesus is no longer talking about the fall of Jerusalem. This has to be the final judgment, because we don't think, they would say to me, that what's described here could apply to the fall of Jerusalem. So then, they started backing me up in all my Bible classes, which totaled thousands of hours, backing me up in these Bible classes. Well, since we're so sure 31 through 46 has to be the end of the world, somewhere prior to that, Jesus started talking about something 2,000 years later, at least, and now counting, than the generation he was talking to. Where did he do that? So some propose this verse, some propose that verse, some propose another verse, and we've been arguing about it, for centuries, I guess. I don't believe Jesus ever changed the subject. I cannot find that transition. So I taught this material, like I did in the morning classes material, very differently in my youth as a preacher. As I got into middle age and now in the older years, I realized, I just really wasn't staying in the context. When I taught that Jesus has two judgments in mind in these three chapters, and that they're separated by at least 2,000 years, I changed my mind. Now let me say this about when that happened. I have always taught precisely and exactly the same thing on Matthew 24 since 1975. I got that one straightened out thanks to Ed Wharton, meaning he taught in Denver, Colorado in 1975. There is not one word in Matthew 24 that's about anything other than the fall of Jerusalem. Taught that since 1975. But I thought for some years that chapter 25 is where he changes the subject. I would also like to add that in churches of Christ, the great majority of us, we believe, largely due to the work and influence of Homer Haley, that all of chapter 24 is about the fall of Jerusalem. You'll find that's pretty common among us. Now, in those congregations we sometimes refer to as liberal, I'll get into all of that, but they have different views on a lot of things, still called churches of Christ, still our brothers and sisters in Christ, I fully expect to see them in heaven, you'll find in the more liberal congregations, they think that Jesus did not change his mind and start talking about the end of the world with the first verse of chapter 25. They think he did it somewhere in the 30s, and they've got at least two or more verses that they'll pick on that. Again, I learned in 1975, all of that chapter is about one thing. Jesus never changed the subject in chapter 24. But for quite a few years in chapter 25, I was not being consistent. I decided, well, it's just got to be about the end of the world then, just 2,000 years after the fall of Jerusalem. I was just sure that had to be the case. So let me labor now to show you why it is that I've changed my mind, yet again, you've been hearing that a lot lately, but into what I believe is a much more consistent view, a much more contextual view, certainly a view that accounts for all of the material or terminology that's in this 25th chapter, I think, much more consistently. So note, we got a judgment scene in chapter 25, verses 31 through 46. You're all very familiar with it. But first, let's do a little bit of deeper Bible study. Let's not just, go on about how this means that. Let's go back and look at the original language, see where this key word, tote, which means then, is used. See every place it is used. When we understand what the word means and every place it is used, an entirely different view of chapters 23 through 25 arises. A consistent view. A view that sees Jesus talking about one topic and not skipping somewhere we can't even figure out where to a totally different thing, skipping from an escapable local judgment in their generation to an inescapable global judgment in our generation or sometime later. Did Jesus do that? And if he did that, where did he do that? I'm arguing he never did do that. He didn't change the subject at all. Now, here's where pencils get really handy and helpful. First, understand that tote, this word tote, the Greek tote, translated then, is very appropriately translated then. I'm not arguing with the translation at all. It will be found in chapter 24, verse 9, verse 10, verse 14, verse 16, verse 21, verse 23, verse 30, twice, 33 and 34, and then again in 40. So we're going to find it nine times total in these locations in the 24th chapter. Now, let's go back to 24 and look at verse 9. Then they will deliver you to tribulation, will kill you, you'll be hated by all nations on account of my name. Circle the word then. It's the first use of tote in Matthew 24. And it's a long way before the 34th verse, which says all these things will take place in this generation. But it is a time stamp. Then, look at verse 10, which is the most helpful verse, I think, in all of this study of tote, at least in the New American Standard, where wisely, rightly, and without any controversy, they have properly translated tote as at that time in the New American Standard. But where you've got then in verse 9, you've got at that time in verse 10, you have one four-letter word in the Greek, both places, tote. Then, a time stamp giving us chronology, giving us location on a timeline. Many will fall away, deliver up one another. In verse 16, then, at that time, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. We're talking about an escapable local judgment. Skip to verse 21. Then, there'll be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. You go to verse 23. Then, if anyone says to you, behold, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe them. You go to 30. Then, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear. And all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. You know, and I'm thinking I got that wrong now. I'm not sure what I did on my chart, but there's two in verse 30. So the two thens are both tote there. Then we go to 33 and 34. I know what I did. Yeah, there's two in verse 30. And then the word is not used in 33 and 34, but I just wanted you to see what happens next. Still prior to the statement, all these things will happen in this generation. Even so, you too, when you see all these things. There's going to be this, 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 then, and when you see all these things, recognize he's near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Then you come to verse 40 for the last occurrence of tote in chapter 24. Then, at that time, there will be two men in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. We discussed it last week. Taken to die or into slavery by the Roman armies. But when we get to chapter 25, this same unbroken chronology, at that time, is the first word in the chapter. Where did Jesus change the subject? Where does he skip over 2,000 years? He does not. That does not happen. We read it in there. We put it in there. We force it in there. I did for years. But it is not found there. What is found there is an unbroken line of time stamps, all referring to at that time when all these things are being described that will take place in this generation. So let's just look at those, and then we'll look at what's in between. 25:1. Then, at that time, the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, 5 were prudent. When the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. The prudent took oil and flasks along with their lamps while the bridegroom was delaying. They all got drowsy and began to sleep. At midnight there was a shout. Behold, the bridegroom comes out, or come out to meet him. Then, 2,000 years later, or then 2,000 years earlier, or then next thing that follows, because it's tote, at that time, the virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. Not 2,000 years between their sleeping and their trimming. Then. Verse 8. The foolish said to the prudent, give us some of your oil for lamps. Our lamps are going out. Prudent answered, saying, no, there will not be enough for us and you. Go instead to the dealers, buy for yourselves. While they're going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came. Those who were ready, the ones that were ready, went in with him to the wedding feast. And the door was shut. Later the other virgins also came, saying, Lord, Lord, open up for us. But he answered and said, truly I say to you, I don't know you. Be on the alert. This is not the word tote for that then. And this is what makes it so important. In verse 13, it's translated then, but it's a different Greek word. This time it's then, as if you add two and two, then you get four. That means a conclusion is drawn. Be on the alert then, since, because you are going to have a day and an hour that you don't know, you want to be ready. Then he uses a different word, not tote in verse 13, but he says the same thing he said all throughout chapter 24. You don't know the day nor the hour. Now, in my Bible, I've highlighted every place that phrase occurs. You don't know the day or the hour. Suddenly we're talking about a different day and a different hour 2,000 years later? No. He used that phrase back in chapter 24 at verse 36. He used that phrase back in 24 at verse 42. He used it in verse 44. He used it in verse 50. Where did he change his mind and start talking about something else? He did not. Then. Now we've completed in 25 down through verse 13. Let's just keep reading. It's just like about a man about to go on a journey. Another illustration. Another parable. Let's see if it's about something else. In verse 14, it's just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, each according to his own ability, went on his journey. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went, traded with them, gained 5 more. In the same manner, one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 went away, dug in the ground, hid his master's money. And after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up, brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me, see, I've gained 5 more. Master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. When we had received the 2 talents came up, said, Master, you trusted me 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You are faithful with a few things. I'll give you, put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up, said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed, and I was afraid. Went away, hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, you wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow, and gather where I scattered no seed. Then not tote, still soon, if I didn't tell you that, S-U-N in the Greek, soon, then you ought to have put money in the bank. Knowing this, then, the conclusion is, you should have put my money in the bank. And on my arrival, I'd have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him, give it to the one who has the 10, for to everyone who has shall more be given. He shall have an abundance, but from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. And cast out the worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he'll sit on his glorious throne. Tote. Brethren, this is just huge. Where's the transition? Where did he get on the horse of a different color in the middle of a stream? Where does he change? Why should the term Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him mean something different in chapter 25 that it did not mean in chapter 24 when it was used before verse 34 that said all these things will take place in this generation? If it's the same coming with the same angels, why isn't it at the same time? It isn't. It's then. It's the same tote that we started back in verse 9 of chapter 24. Then. Not 2,000 years from now, ever. Then. 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he'll sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him. He'll separate them one from another. As a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. We'll find out how and by what lights, what is the criteria for the judgment in a moment. He'll put the sheep on his right, goats on the left. Then, at that time, then, when the coming of the Son of Man with all of his angels in glory that he's already told us will take place in this generation, at that time, the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom. It doesn't say go to heaven. The kingdom that's been promised in Daniel 2 and so many other places. Inherit that kingdom. There won't be Jews anymore. They were destroyed or enslaved. There won't be Moses' law anymore to act as a rival to the only kingdom and Jesus reigning from heaven over it. Inherit it. Not go to heaven. Get uncluttered title, if you will. Now look at this, 34. The king will say to those on his right, come, you are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. He's not skipping over the church age. He's not skipping over these last 2,000 years. He is giving them entrance into it. We've been preparing for it, but struggling under Jewish persecution. And on this generation, all the righteous blood shed on earth from Adam to Abraham. From Abel to Zechariah. Slipped a gear there. Is going to be held against this generation. That's what he said. Now in 35. I was hungry. You gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty. You gave me drink. I was a stranger. You invited me in. Naked. You clothed me. Sick. You visited me. I was in prison. You came to me. And then, at that time, the righteous will say to him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and gave you drink? When did we see you a stranger and invited you in? Or naked and clothed you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, now let these words, brethren, sink very deeply into your ears, your mind, and your heart. Because it is the only criteria for the judgment under consideration that is given in the context. The king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Then, a couple of millenniums later, at the same time in 41, it's still Tote. He'll also say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you accursed ones, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, you did not invite me in. Naked, you didn't clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me." Then they themselves also will answer, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger or naked or sick in prison, didn't take care of you?" Then, last time, Tote, he'll answer them saying, "Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these," "you did not do it to me." And these will go away into eternal punishment. Now, I gave you some, teasers. Does that word say eternal punishing? Is the punishment eternal? Or is the punishing eternal? Which does the verse say? It does not say they'll be punished eternally in the sense of being endlessly punished. It says what punishment they get will be eternal. And then it ends with verse 46. These will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Now, I know I'm trying to do, a whole chapter in one lesson. But Matthew 25's judgment criteria, the standard by which the sheep and the goat are judged, is stipulated. And I used to add a whole lot more. I was real sure I could find it everywhere else. And because it wasn't here, I should just read it in. So, I read in the final judgment. I read in whether or not the grace of God has forgiven you of your sins. Whether or not you had been a man of faith or a woman of faith who'd come to Jesus. That it was based on the life of Jesus. That it had something to do with a pure and undefiled religion. I read all these things into this context. But I could not find them there. I could not read them on the page. There is only one criteria. One standard for this judgment. That is this. How did you treat the saints? And if you didn't treat them well, you are doomed to a punishment that is eternal, but not an eternal punishing. You will be destroyed in this generation if you do not accept your Messiah. I understand how difficult this is. It took me quite a few years to get this straightened out. I know, brethren, how past teaching lingers in our minds. When I was able to break free of it enough to read what was on the page and accept what was not, and when I was able to restrain myself enough to stop reading into these expressions what is not attached to them in either the Old Testament or the New, I changed my mind about this passage and about eternal torment. I'm suggesting, I've already had one or two of you come and say, "I really wish you'd do a class now on eternal torment." Does God do worse than Saddam Hussein is the question. We were horrified at the torture chambers of Saddam Hussein. We recoiled rightly in horror at the torture chambers of Saddam Hussein. Same way we recoil at the idea of a crucifixion. It is just against nature to want to torment people as viciously and as long as you can. We just recoil in horror. I think there's a good reason for that. It's because God doesn't do that either. Now, we'll get into the study, maybe. We'll see in a little while, maybe. But, brethren, at this point, I'm just suggesting I had to redo all my study, and it took years.
I had to go and look at the Old Testament passages. I had to look at the New Testament passages. I had to get a fix on the book of Revelation. I had to understand what eternal means. Then, finally, I realized, well, what do you know? Jesus talking to the same men over the course of maybe 20 or 30 minutes never changed the subject because I can't find the transition. So I'm challenging you now. Bring it to me. Where clearly in 23, 24, or 25 did Jesus say, I was talking about your generation and you'd see all these things. Now I'm going to talk about something that you'll be dead for 2,000 years and then these other things will happen. Where did he do that? You'll have to come and show it to me. So this is the only judgment here. How'd you treat the saints? The same judgment you have in Matthew 24. When all these things will take place in this generation. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. And then will fall the entire Jewish system. The temple will be burned to the ground. And the saints will inherit the kingdom and the wedding feast of the Lamb now. As Revelation uses those terms, you will look upon the corpses of those who were not saved by getting out of the city and maintaining their lives. Now then, wouldn't you all like to go home and get something to eat? I'll bet. Okay. So rather, you know, this is hardly material that we look at as being an encouragement to come to Christ. And yet I really think it should be. That has been for me, I think, the greatest revelation of all, is that this material that we think is not intended to bring people to Christ is just so that. This is, brethren, in all the Bible, the most extensive and particular and minutely precise and elaborate prophecy in the entire Bible. And if these things took place in the time frame that Jesus said they would, then Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and you will never find in your Bible a more compelling proof. Everything he said in these chapters took place then, before those men died, in this generation, and even before they finished the cities of Israel. It happened 40 years later. Jesus is in heaven. Here is where he reigns. Come to him if you have not. Come and ask more questions, and let's be doing the Bible study if you're not sure yet. But come as